Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 351, Transforming the World. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And you know, in our podcast, we often have a short series of episodes on a particular topic, and then we think about that topic, and then we move on to a new topic. There are some topics that we've actually explored here and there over the course of this entire over 350 episodes. And one of those series of episodes is when we talk to somebody that we have admired a lot and we just want to learn from them and talk to them and hear about how they thought back in the day in the 60s and the 70s in this case. And in particular, when we sit down with somebody who has offered us memories of Jewish justice movements of the past and broader justice movements, and also is working on making sure that those remain relevant in our day. Today, we are thrilled to be sitting down with Michael Lerner to be doing just that. Michael Lerner is a theologian, an activist, a rabbi, and a psychotherapist. He's probably most famous as the founder and publisher of Tikkun magazine, and he also serves as the rabbi of Beit Tikkun Synagogue, which meets in San Francisco, Berkeley, and Zoom. Michael Lerner was a national leader of the anti-war movement of the 1960s, and he was chair of the Berkeley chapter of Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. Back in those days, Michael Lerner was described by J. Edgar Hoover as, quote, one of the most dangerous criminals in America. Sounds like somebody we'd like to talk to. And decades later, as we entered the 21st century, Michael Lerner helped to organize the Network of Spiritual Progressives. In addition to rabbinical ordination, Michael Lerner holds a PhD in philosophy and a PhD in clinical psychology. He is the author of many books, including Jewish Renewal and The Left Hand of God, both national bestsellers, and his most recent work, published in 2019, is entitled Revolutionary Love, a Political Manifesto to Heal and Transform the World. It's a great honor to have him here for this conversation. So, Michael Lerner, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's a thrill to have you on.
It's an honor for me to be invited.
Well, I thought that maybe a good place to start with you would be to think about how in Judaism, we often try to make an analogy between the time in which we're living and some historical or mythic time in Jewish history. Like, this is just like the Exodus from Egypt, or this is just like the Babylonian exile. And I was thinking that maybe with you, we could have a certain conversation that talks about how our time is and is not like the 60s and the 70s when you were starting on your journey of this work.
Well, it's very similar and very different. What's similar is that the United States is involved in a variety of very bad behaviors, not taking care of at least 50% of the population. A lot of suffering in this society, and that was true also in the past. And we also have some very important differences. There was no serious fascistic movement in the 50s, 60s, or 70s. The country had been at war with a fascist power, and even though the government of the United States was bringing in former fascists, former Nazis, to work on our on some of our military programs, there was no movement that was like that. Today, we have in this country a serious movement of people who are explicitly pro what the Nazis were about, and that's happening all over the world. The first big ally of German fascism was Italy. Well, guess what? Italy just elected a fascist government. And there are many other governments in the world right now that are either on the verge of being either Nazi or fascistic government, or they are leaning in that direction, but not calling it that. Another difference is that in the 60s, there was a whole new generation of people, young people. I was young then, and we were without fear. We knew that we had learned the lessons of Nazism, and we absolutely believed that it was critical that we stand up and do something. And although, like today, many people were at first very reluctant to get involved because of the need to protect oneself, it quickly developed over the course of just a few years that a large movement, a unified movement against the war in Vietnam, and another movement that was pretty unified in support of African-American liberation, they both were there. And for a short time, it was a very beautiful reality. Today, we don't have that kind of reality. We have many different movements, some of which share specific narrow visions of what they want, but actually very few of them are able to cooperate with each other. It has dramatically undermined the ability of a progressive movement to unify and to challenge the real racism and the real sexism that is around us.
So let me ask you then, can you talk a little bit about the role of Judaism? In particular, I'm thinking, you know, in the 70s or 80s, you had various critiques of Judaism, of the Jewish world, of ways in which Judaism needed to manifest in different ways in order to better promote social justice back then. And I'm wondering if now you have the same or different ideas about what Judaism might be able to contribute into this world and maybe be a source for why people would take to the streets in the way that you're talking about, or whatever the other coalition building and everything that you've been talking about.
There's a growing group of younger Jews who are very alienated from the Jewish world because the organized Jewish community today still stands unified with Israel, regardless of how many outrages are happening, how much oppression of Palestinians. And it is happening day after day. So that is a hindrance that makes it harder to even elect progressive Jews. In a recent election that was taking place for selecting Democratic Party or Republican Party candidates, a few of the most progressive Jews got defeated by forces that have been mobilized by AIPAC. AIPAC is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and it is an alliance with another group that it helped create to intervene in elections and side with people who are the least critical of anything that is being done in Israel. Well, there are a lot of Jews who in the United States who are critical of it. And so they came in and defeated one of the most prominent Jewish families that has been in Congress for the past 40 years.
This is in reference to Andy Levin, who recently lost a Democratic primary for Michigan's 11th congressional district after a great deal of AIPAC funding for his opponent.
And other groups that have our other candidates who have been critical of Israel. Now, that is undermining the ability of the Jewish world to play a positive role in American elections. I'm sad about it because I want Israel to be able to be secure. And it's never going to be secure as long as it's dominating Palestinian people. This is a tragedy for Israel. And inside Israel itself, Israeli politics have moved further and further to the right, so that now there's even a fascist party that is likely to become part of the government, of the next government. I mean, this is terrible for us, but it's terrible for the Jewish people as a whole. But I have to add that I do believe that one of the great dangers to the world today is all the forms of nationalism. Nationalism, in my view, is just another variant of looking out for number one, and which is actually the essence of global capitalism. But looking out for number one is a value that leads people to dislike or even attack others. So that is a lot more like the 1930s than it is the 1960s.
I really appreciate hearing you reflect on this over the decades. I mean, I've known about your work for a while, and I read your book, Jewish Renewal, a number of years ago that we'll put a link in our show notes to that book. When I think about people out there, and I say people as opposed to rabbis, but you are a rabbi, but like when I think about all people that are really on the front lines, sort of showing how what we call activism or justice work on the one hand, and on the other hand, what we call, you know, spirituality or meaning making or religious concerns on the other. Like, if I think of people that are weaving those two things together, justice and spirituality, you are really high on my mental list of people that are doing that. And I'm personally grateful to you for that as one of the, you know, younger generation that has inherited a world where, like, I look around and there's a lot of Jewish organizations that I can be a part of that are speaking specifically through progressive lenses. Some of them call themselves, you know, secular. Some of them call themselves religious. Some of them, whatever, I don't really care. But due to the work of people, not just you, but many groups you are part of, I and many others like me just sort of take for granted that we have a whole panoply of justice-seeking Jewish organizations. But I actually want to put aside for a second the Jewish specific stuff, because I know so much of your work in the world has been around building bridges between people of different religious traditions. And I'm curious a little bit to hear, like, what is the story of your work, not just to shift, you know, the Jewish community and change the values that drive Jewish organizations, but also to bridge from Jewish communities to communities that are other religious in nature?
I've been interested in this issue since my mentor at the Jewish Theological Seminary, Abraham Joshua Heschel, took up the issue with regard to the Catholic Church and tried to convince the Catholic Church to change some of its most anti-Semitic formulations, particularly in relationship to words that they use on Good Friday and on Easter. He made an impact and made it possible for them to tone down, but not eliminate, the negation of Jews or the way of putting Jews as being somehow critical to the crucifixion. I saw him do that, and there were many in the Jewish world who said, don't do that. You can't talk to those Catholics, or don't try to get some compromise. There was a lot of dissension around that, but he went right ahead, very courageous. And then he took the next step of joining with Martin Luther King Jr. to the struggles for African-American rights. So I saw the tremendous potential of working together for human rights. For a religious person like myself, when I read the Torah, it says over and over again, the most frequently repeated injunction in Torah are various forms of the following. When you go get into your country, that is you being the Jewish people who have been enslaved in Egypt for 400 years, when you get into your country, do not oppress the stranger. Remember that you were strangers in the land of Egypt.
I wanted, before we got too much farther, to just take a second to hear about your sort of personal work constructing, I don't know if constructing is the right word, but in kickstarting Tikkun, the publication that you've overseen for a number of decades. And first off, I asked a lot of our guests about the names of their organizations, especially when those names are in Hebrew or other languages. And Tikkun is a specific conscious choice for the name of a publication. Tikkun, you could translate a number of ways. I would probably translate it like repairing or fixing. And it tends to be tied to repairing the world in various ways. But talk us through, like, what gap did you perceive in Jewish life? Why did you start up this project Tikkun? And what has it been up to this last incredible few decades?
Tikkun as a magazine was started precisely to declare that we are Jews who are proud of our Jewishness, and we are not apologists for it. We're not afraid to be seen as Jews. And this was being done at the height of Reagan, President Reagan. And many Jews had decided at that point to move to the right. They thought the energy of the country is moving to the right, and we Jews need to be strong right-wing force as well. It didn't actually happen that they were successful in moving them far to the right, but they were trying to be like everyone else. And the right wing in the United States had at that time a very assimilationist consciousness. We were not assimilationists. We were proud of our Judaism, into our Judaism, but at the same time, wanting to bring other people in, including other Jews in, without feeling that they were estranged totally. Okay, so the choice about the word tikkun was this. Most people didn't know what tikkun was. So it was a teaching process that was going on. Even today, I run into people who say, oh yeah, I like your magazine, Tycoon. Okay. And some think it's about money, or, you know, you've got a lot of money or something like that. Tycoon. But we wanted to legitimate a position that was pro-Judaism, okay, as well as being pro-liberal and pro-progressive. That was not a position that was often heard at that point. There was a variant of it in the Reform movement, but the Reform movement was, let's say, from our standpoint, was very weak in the degree to which its tikkun olam work actually infected the local synagogues in the Reform movement. You know, the people who did it inside the Reform movement were great, and they became allies for us, and they were on our original board. But the actual reality of Reform Judaism was that it wasn't so much involved. And the reason was that a significant section of people in the Reform movement were well off, and they were feeling like, we don't want to get involved in anybody who's thinking that we should be reducing our income. So we were making a very strong statement that we are Jews, we're using Jewish values, and we are moving forward with that consciousness. We felt a need to broaden the discourse that we had started to develop in 1986 when we founded the magazine. So that led us to turn towards some of the more progressive voices in the Christian world and say, we should be making alliances with you and others. That didn't work too well. In the Christian world, very wonderful progressives. Jim Wallace, we approached Jim Wallace. He came to and spoke at one of our conferences, or maybe two of our conferences. But then he decided that his movement would be more impactful if they were really seen as a specifically Christian and, in fact, for him, evangelical Christian organization. And so when I asked him to become part of our leadership, he said, no, this is not going to work for me, because if I want to be taken seriously by the evangelicals, they don't want to be connected to the Jews. Not because they're anti-Semitic, because they're willing to support Israel, okay, which was their criterion for not being anti-Semitic. But this Jewish stuff, no, the right way for us, if we're going to have a religious movement, is one that is affirming of our version of Christianity. And they felt they needed to distance. It hasn't been as easy as I had hoped to build alliances of the sort that should be there.
Can we talk about, since you've, on the one hand, been an activist and an important activist, and on the other hand, sort of in some ways best known as this thought leader, as somebody who has run Tikkun for all this time. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you see the interplay between ideas and activism, in particular as it pertains to the Jewish community, because I think there's a lot of people who seem today to be doing a lot of stuff experiments and a lot of activity. And then there's other people that seem to be doing a lot of thinking. But I'm wondering whether we don't have the connection between the two right. And I'm wondering if you could reflect on that connection in the rearview mirror, like you're talking about back then and today also.
Well, many of the activists have come from communities which had experienced as kids very reactionary ideas. And even when the Jewish world officially opened for itself, for example, to gays and lesbians, and that was a great opening, it didn't transfer into a lot of activists feeling comfortable with the Jewish world because they had had very bad experiences growing up in the Jewish world when it was still rather sexist and racist. And there's a lot of misunderstanding about why that's happening, but in fact it is happening. And We Tikkun was the first magazine, actually the first voice in the Jewish world, to publish a rabbi who was also gay. We were able to break down a lot of barriers by doing that.
An Orthodox rabbi, right?
He was an Orthodox rabbi.
Yeah, you're talking about Steve Greenberg, who at that time wrote as Yaakov Levado.
Exactly. But he only printed it with Tikkun on condition that we never reveal his identity. Then a few years later, he felt safe enough to reveal his identity there.
I guess what I'm asking you to talk about is why you think ideas are important to activists. And you know, because I think a lot of people don't, a lot of funders, a lot of various people in the Jewish community don't, in my view, appreciate the power of ideas enough. And we are seeing many, many fewer magazines today, many fewer places to publish, many fewer, you know, and I'm wondering if you could sort of speak to why, if you still do think so, it was important to have a magazine like Tikkun. It continues to be, and that there should be others like it.
Yeah, I do believe that the more the merrier, and that the more that we can get a Jewish intellectual life flourishing that has not necessarily religious, but has some corner for religion and some corner for people who are anti-religious and some people who are whatever, but who are taking ideas seriously. Taking ideas seriously has been part of Judaism for the past at least 2,500 years. And the ideas that need to be addressed are ideas that are not just Jewish ideas, but they are universal ideas. More and more and more, what Tikkun has done is to move towards articulating a vision based on a notion that real problems in our society, the real political problems, the real cultural problems, are based on the ethos of selfishness and materialism that are another way of saying global capitalism and various forms of nationalism. So I've come to the conclusion, and many of us our readers have too, that the real struggle is not just about very specific ways in which selfishness and materialism play out, but against the core idea of selfishness and materialism, and to replace them with other ideas, namely a world of love, caring, kindness, generosity, and environmental sensitivity. That's the real struggle that has to happen. In order for that to happen, you have to engage in the ideas, because so many people who have good hearts and really want to end the environmental crisis, or really want to end the suffering of African Americans, or really want to do other very good things, run up against the following: that their organizations are funded at the top by the super rich, who don't want to have anything to do with a language that challenges their right to have vastly disproportionate wealth from everybody else. So in my books, I've really taken this on, particularly the last few years, and tried to show people that you're never going to get a society that is based on any kind of Jewish values, or for that matter, any kind of spiritual values, because we're not only talking to religious people, we're talking to people who are have a spiritual sensitivity, even though they have no connection to a religion. There's no way you're going to get people to engage in the struggle that needs to happen until you've got people who understand the way in which the ethos and the teachings of global capitalism and nationalism are critical to supporting inequalities in the society. Now, I've written about this extensively because I discovered it while I was principal investigator of a research on the psychodynamics of American working people. And what I learned there was that a critical part of what many working people whose economic interests were with the left, but were nevertheless moving to the right, what they heard from the left was a version of blaming them for their failures. They accepted the notion that this was a meritocracy, a society ruled by merit, and that if you weren't making it, it was because you didn't have the merit. You weren't smart enough. You hadn't worked hard enough, something. And that moved so many people away. And it's still happening right now. The last presidential candidate before the current president was Hillary Clinton, who said, "Oh, those people are a bundle of deplorables." I can't tell you how many times that statement was then rerun by the right in all of their many, many, many places to give people the feeling that these leftists have disrespect for you. But then add on to that a second issue, disrespect for any form of religion. They think it's all reactionary. So many people in the left and in the liberal world feel like they dare not associate with anything that seems so flaky to them as religion. So there needs to be a huge education to help people understand that people who have searching for meaning and purpose in their lives are not flakes. There's a real need for a very large section of this population, particularly those who are working in work that has no meaning and purpose except to get money for the rich or the upper middle class. So you're not going to be able to talk to them if they feel that they are being looked down upon because of their religion, because they go to church. And often they go to church for a reason that's a good reason. We need an intellectual branch that can help dismantle the anti-religious consciousness in the left, at least enough to help them understand that the core of their vision of anti-religious vision is not intellectually sustainable. It's based on the view that that which is real is that which can be verified through sense datum or measured. That ideology led people to then think, well, all this stuff, it must just be some pure baloney.
I really appreciate hearing all of this from you. I have one final question for me. Dan, I think, has one more to close. But my final question, it's a simple and a complicated one at the same time. My final question boils down to, why be Jewish? Like, why be Jewish? And I'm not asking it as a challenge. Like, I'm pretty buckled in to Jewish life. Like, I'm very much on board. You know, here I am co-hosting a Jewish podcast and devoting a lot of my life to these questions. But I ask it because I really feel like you can give a bird's eye view over a span of time that I certainly can't. And you've done so much work that is specifically about bridging between different kinds of people. And I think it might surprise people. I mean, maybe not if they know your work well, but if they're just getting to know your work, like, it might surprise people how thoroughly and completely you are not, to use the language you used before, an assimilationist. Like, your universalism, your commitment to universal values is not about discarding anything Jewish. It's about finding lots of things that are Jewish that also resonate with values that are what I would term, I don't know, extra Jewish, like outside of just Judaism. Given that, you know, why? If somebody could be committed to the values you and I and our listeners hold dear without being deeply embedded in Jewish life. Like, what is it that Judaism brings to the equation that is compelling and worthwhile for all of us to really engage with?
Well, first I want to say that when people ask me that, I say, go find any tradition that has some spiritual depth that makes sense to you. You don't have to be Jewish to live a good life. Mm-hmm. You can go to anything. So if you've grown up in a Jewish community and doesn't have anything to offer you, go try someplace else. There's something in the spiritual dimension of reality that your body will hunger for, okay? So try some other spiritual tradition. Maybe it'll work better for you. God bless you if you do it, you know? I am not recruiting to Judaism per se. I'm recruiting to God. Understanding God is a whole other thing because I don't believe in God as a big man in heaven sending down judgments and rewarding the good people and punishing the bad people. In fact, I'm absolutely outraged that God doesn't exist because I wish he, she, it was there so I could denounce them. But but unfortunately, that's not the God I believe in. The God that I believe in is the force of healing and transformation in the universe, the force that makes possible the transformation from that which is to that which ought to be. And he, she, it, or whatever doesn't involve herself, himself, itself in the details of this particular planet. We have 100 billion galaxies, okay? He, she, it is not particularly involved in each one of them. But it is the force in the universe that makes possible transformation from that which is to that which ought to be. And no matter where you go, if you can believe that there is that force, that's a message that comes from Judaism as a core message. The world is not stuck. Tikkun is possible, that the transformation from that which is to that which ought to be, that's what a true religion should be about. And what keeps people stuck is their desire to be realistic. And I said, don't be realistic, because realistic means accepting the view of what's possible that has been projected on you since you were a tiny little kid, from your parents, from the school system, from the workplace, every place. They're telling you what's realistic. The political leaders, they all have a way of communicating to you what's realistic that sticks you into this particular moment. What Judaism had to say is, no, there is a force in the universe that makes possible the transformation from that which is to that which ought to be. And that force, which we call Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, or any, those are four Hebrew letters that stand for a transformative power of the universe. That is important. That's important to believe. And you can find that in any religion, or at least any religion that I know of. I mean, there's the other religion, that's capitalism. And most people in most religions are primarily assimilated into the capitalist order. But I say, go to any religion. Judaism is great. We have this notion that we actually experience the possibility of possibility. That is, that you're in a reality that looks impossible to change, and yet there's a teaching that says, no, it's not impossible, and there's something in the universe that makes it possible for that which is to be transformed to that which ought to be. And you can be part of that by being part of a people that believes that and help people, other people, overcome their sense that they're stuck, that the world is basically materialistic, basically looking out for number one, basically maximizing self-interest. And we're saying, no, it's not. That's not true. It's not the way the world is. And Judaism has a good measure, a good thing to say about that. And I've just given you what that thing is to say. But if that doesn't appeal to you, go someplace else. There are other forms of spiritual life that will give you something of value. So I'm sorry I can't answer the question why you should be Jewish, because I'm not saying you should be. You should only be if you can find in it what I found in it and what many others have found in it, which is this message that the world can be healed and transformed, that tikkun is possible, and that we are the agents of that transformation.
I'm thinking about the power of storytelling and the power of narrative, and I'm wondering whether we have a Jewish narrative or how we would go about a Jewish narrative that registers for people without them having to do mental gymnastics to sort of put on three layers of metaphors and all that, you know, whether there's a way of telling stories that capture people's imaginations who, like you and like me, don't believe that if there is a being out there, that that being certainly has any time to pay attention to us out of the billions of other galaxies. So it's sort of irrelevant whether there's a God, whether there's not a God. It's just a question of we have a set of stories that we've inherited that seem to posit a way that the world is organized that I think most Jews don't really believe anymore. And yet it feels like we haven't really given them an alternative story that's as compelling and as digestible, but is more in accord with their contemporary sort of understandings of the world. And I'm desperate for that.
I agree with you, but the Exodus story really has a way of looking at the world that is transformative. And I invite you to come and study Torah with me. We do it twice a month on Zoom. I show there how the message that is the core message in Torah, one version of it is liberatory. I say one version of it because the other thing that I teach in my Torah study is that there are two voices in Torah. There's a voice that's a liberatory voice, and there's a voice that is the voice of power and domination. And both of them are in conflict. That's been true since the Torah was written, that there are two different and alternative voices in Torah. And why are they there? Well, because the people who put the Torah together, some of them were people who are realistic and want to recognize that the world is run by power and domination and control. So even in the Torah, you've got two voices, but two voices is better than no voice, okay? The people who put that together were smart enough to realize that if you wanted to have this teaching accepted, that you had to allow the other voice to be heard as well. And so the Torah has two different voices in it, and they're often in conflict. If you look at the United States and its founding documents, you don't find any place there that suggests that there's an obligation to care for the poor, for the weak, or to love people, to love not just the people who are close to you, not just your neighbor. That's the one that the Christian world picked up on. Love your neighbor. No, we say love the stranger also. Okay, just as important. Yes, it would be great to have that story. That story is in Torah, but I'd welcome you to write a version of it that doesn't have any God stuff in it and bring that into the Jewish world, because that's also can be helpful. I'm not a narrow thinker, okay? The world is in desperate shape and it needs a different way of thinking. And it doesn't have to be a Jewish way, but it does have to be a liberatory way.
Thank you so much, Michael Lerner, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's been a great opportunity to speak to some Jews. Jewish tradition, it has beautiful things in it, and it has rotten things in it. And we don't have to accept them all. That's my message. Build on whatever is good in our tradition, or if you don't want to, find another tradition and build on what's good in that one. But do something to counter the hurtfulness and the selfishness and the materialism. They have to be replaced. And that is the core to saving this world from destruction at this moment. This planet, I mean, I don't mean the whole universe, but this planet. I like this planet.
Well, that is the perfect note to end on. We also like this planet, and there's no way to end a conversation with Michael Lerner better than reflecting on how we need to transform this planet. So thank you so much again for listening to all of you out there who are doing so. And we want to close out this conversation in the same way that we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram pages. All of those are at Judaism Unbound for our handles. Second, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. Check out our Unyeshiva. Check out all of our other interesting things that we have living there. Show notes for this podcast episode and others and more. And you can always email us at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. We love hearing your questions, your comments, your thoughts. All of that is fantastic. And the last thing we would mention is that we really deeply appreciate if you are able to financially support us with a gift of any amount. And you can do that on either a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift via judaismunbound.com/donate. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.